Picture Wrestling Podcast. My name is John McAdam. As they say, give us 60 minutes and we will give you a wicked good podcast. I am not only excited about this podcast, I'm excited about this entire month's podcast because we have termed this the October of Inquiry, where if you join our Facebook group, more on that in a moment, you get to ask a question, and if you get answer it early enough, we will answer it on the air. So if you have not already joined our Facebook group, please do so. Now, I hand this over to Sean Goodwin, as I do every week. He talks about our Facebook group. Before I do that, Sean, I have a question. Wouldn't you agree, baby, you and me got a groovy kind of Stick to Wrestling podcast?
I almost thought we got away with it this time. Our Facebook group's the best. I don't know what to tell you. It's not only do we have the cool question thing for the next month that John's all excited about, but have you been looking at our Facebook page the last couple of days, you have seen a dark-haired Freddie Blassie teaming up with Nick Bockwinkel's dad, both baby faces in a tag match. You also saw a young mustachioed Richard Blood in the AWA, who would later become Ricky Steamboat. All kinds of good stuff happening.
All right. Also, from our Facebook page, we just finished up Pro Wrestling. Stick to Wrestling, Fantasy Baseball, and someone named Gordon's Flask won the thing. So congratulations to whoever that individual was. I tried to figure it out, but I couldn't. Also, follow me on Twitter. If you put in the name John McAdam, there is a picture of a guy hitting another guy with a chair. Follow that dude. I don't stick to wrestling. Today, I tweeted out that I retweet that Donald Trump is just like the Hulk, only instead of turning green, he turns orange, and instead of getting stronger when he's angry, he gets dumber. Just something I retweeted, kids. Anyway, this week our guest is someone who also has a show on the Arcadian Vanguard podcast network. Let me bring in Barry Rose. Barry, thank you for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. John reached out to me earlier in the week and said, would you like to come on a professional podcast instead of what you guys are doing over there?
That's exactly what I said.
That's it, word for word. And I said, I would absolutely love to do that so I could see what takes place in the palatial studios of the Stick to Wrestling podcast world. So, yes, I'm excited to be here, John and Sean. Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're very welcome. So you'll be taking notes.
Oh, absolutely. I've got Sweet Lewis taking notes for me as well. But yes, we are taking notes, and hopefully I can bring this back and I can share with my partner, Jeff Bowdrin, the booker, and maybe we can spice things up a little bit over on our side. So, yeah, but I'm very excited to be here.
Higher hopes than I do about Jeff, sir. But anyway. All right. So, Sean, you are the point guard for this week's show. Sean will be feeding us questions. Barry, you are the guest, so you will be going first.
Wow, very exciting.
As always, we open the mailbag floodgates and just a cornucopia of questions. I am not only happy to see Barry here, but I'm also happy to see Barry because of question number two, which my answer will be, I'll tell you in advance, I agree with Barry and John. Okay. But before we get to that, from Jamie Waldrop, and again, with the usual proviso, I'm promising you I'm going to butcher some names. I saw two names down lower on where I just kind of, you know, manly had a tear. You know, it wasn't one of those Barney Rubble crying things, but, you know. So I'm promising I'm going to butcher somebody's name. Anyway, Jamie, how do you think it would have turned out if Dusty would have kept Steamboat as the top babyface instead of running him off? It certainly would have affected WrestleMania 3, but what about JCP? What do you think, Barry?
I think it would have made JCP a lot better had they kept him around. And I never truly understood it. I certainly have heard the versions on why Steamboat left and that, you know, basically the blame does fall upon Dusty's shoulders. Who were your top baby faces in 85? I guess you had Dusty, you had Magnum. I guess Wyndham was still a top baby face in 85. Within the next year or so, I think there was a little bit of a shift. The car accident took place. Nikita, I think had they kept Steamboat, he would have been arguably the top one, two, or three baby face in the promotion. And it would have given us Steamboat versus Flair on a national stage 4 years earlier. It was 89 when that was all taking place. So it would have been 4 years earlier. I think it would have been great. I don't think Steamboat wanted to leave. At least that was my understanding. I think he was kind of forced out and had a great offer, so he went. But I think he would have been thrilled to stay home in the Carolinas. And I think his fans, I think we would have won if he would have stayed.
Yeah, there's no question in my mind that Ricky Steamboat would have preferred staying at home. I mean, he had been there almost his entire career. He had his gym there. On the other side, he had been there for 8 years, and I think Ricky might have been getting a little bit stale by this point. I don't want to speak for Ricky Steamboat, but I think he saw the writing on the wall as far as, you know, how he was going to be used. Already since Dusty had been there, he had kind of been used to get other guys over. Wahoo in the summer of 1984, then Tully at Starrcade. I also have heard that Rick Steamboat just did not like Dusty Rhodes, period. I mean, I think him heading to the WWF may have been best for everybody. I also wanted to throw this in. I mean, don't get me wrong, he was a great performer. It's just that he may have been in one place for too long. I wanted to throw this in. Ricky Steamboat may have been the perfect example of what it was like when a guy went to the WWF. He showed up on WWF TV as a black boots and black trunks guy, just like he was in Mid-Atlantic. His only gimmick was he had the lei around his neck. And then maybe 4 or 5 months into it, I want to say like late spring, early summer 1985, they found the gimmick that they liked for him, which was the Karate Kid gimmick.
My concern with Ricky at this point is it's one of those things where he would have been better 5 years earlier. You know, say you put him in like the mid 70s and he would have been just a massive, I mean, he was a superstar anyway, but his persona was so clear cut, and he was so that kind of almost Bob Backlund-esque. Earlier on, from what I understand, it had a little more of an edge to it. You know, he kind of had the ladies man with the mustache and everything, but by this time that was, I mean, he had the run with, he had the good run with Jay. But I'm wondering how much he had left in the tank at this point, from what John's saying, but from the other way, meaning I don't know. I don't think he had anything left in the tank. I think he needed to walk away. Barry, did you notice that around that time?
Yeah, I'm not really sure. I know that we can say that, too. But I think partly whether he was getting stale or not, this was the national expansion. So, you know, it had gone from Mid-Atlantic and now it was a national company. So you're exposing Steamboat. I can say exposing on the on this podcast, right? Exposing.
Of course.
Okay, just making sure. So he would be exposed now to a brand new audience, I think. So I don't know. It's there were a lot of issues with Dusty that I was aware of. A lot of that actually went back to Steamboat's time in Florida in 1976 when Dusty was on top there. And even though he wasn't the booker, he was running the show. So their issues do go back years. But I don't know. I think the thought of, you know, Steamboat Flair a little bit earlier, but even Steamboat involved with the Horsemen and all the angles that could have been done, I just think would have been so cool. You know, he does have that Bob Backlund thing in a sense. And I definitely could see where you were going with that, because he's this clean cut baby face, not as goofy as Backlund by any stretch, but he's got this, you know, even though he's Asian, he's got this all American kind of happy, good looking baby face thing going for him. I think he would have been a great fit. And I think the quality of matches, I was not a gigantic fan of the WWF in the mid 80s. You know, certainly it was, you know, the biggest promotion in the US, if not the world at that time. But at the same time, you know, you were getting one or two good matches per card where there was just a lot of junk. And usually it did involve Steamboat. So I don't know, just the thought of Steamboat mixed in with all that talent in JCP. And I'm talking as it from a fan's perspective. I think we would have won that for sure.
No, I can definitely see that. I mean, and I know what you're saying. Like Bob Backlund, Ricky Steamboat definitely was a Bob Backlund, all-American, soft-spoken on the mic type. I mean, the business was getting further away from that, even though, of all places in the WWF, Ricky Steamboat got a huge push. You know, he was in main events against Morocco. He had a big series against Jake, and then he won the Intercontinental title from Randy Savage. So if he was successful in the WWF, I can't help but think in a national NWA or a national JCP that he would have gotten over. The only thing was, when I saw him live in the Northeast in 1989, Ricky got a lot of boos, and it sucked because I was a big fan of his. I didn't think he deserved that. But when he went around the horn against Lex Luger, I mean, I saw that in Boston, Philly, and Baltimore, and Ricky got a ton of boos. Maybe that had something to do with Luger being the super cool heel, but it happened.
Yeah, that was my concern. And I didn't mean the goofiness part with Backlund. Yeah, you're right. I just meant more along the lines of the everything's black and white, as opposed to where you start. Even with Hogan. Hogan cheated, you know, his ass off during these matches. It was so – but this is, of course, a hypothetical because this never, ever, ever happens in a million years. Dusty does not allow this to ever happen. So,
yeah.
But it's a nice thought. Okay, now we get to the question I'm very glad Barry's here for. From Jesus, we have, which Japanese stars could be major players in the territories and or national TV from the 70s or 90s? Please, Barry.
Yeah, so obviously, this is almost a loaded question. You know exactly where I'm going to go. I think Jesus, not even knowing that I was guesting on the show this week, somehow through osmosis or something, figured out to ask this question. But Jumbo Sharuta, who I have, you know, I have praised him to no end on many different levels. I think Jumbo Sharuta could have been a gigantic star. And I'm not talking mid-80s AWA, but I'm talking late 70s in territories, in Florida for me specifically. I mean, if we had gotten him, and no doubt the way that the booking was, he would have been brought in as a heel. And I should say, too, Jumbo Sharuta did make a couple of appearances in Florida in 76 and 77. And he was, I don't know if I could say he was a heel. It might have been very subtle. He wrestled Eddie Graham and Say Pete, and then wrestled Billy Robinson in Miami Beach. And that match was actually taped for Japanese television. And I sat ringside, and it was super exciting. But I think Sharuta, I think he was so good in the ring, but he also had a look. There was a certain look, a certain dynamic about him that I think he could have transcended what we saw in the 70s and early 80s as far as Japanese wrestling. And I think, you know, there were the stereotypes. It was very bizarre in Florida because we would get Japanese wrestlers all the time, but they were generally prelim wrestlers. And even if they weren't, they were going to be relegated to prelim. So right. We had a young Ricky Choshu that spent 6 to 8 months in Florida in 1975 under the name Mitsu Yoshida, which I believe is his given name. So, you know, granted, he was a young boy at the time. He wasn't a superstar, but I think even a guy like Choshu, I think coming back 78, maybe through 82, 83 and continuing, certainly. But Choshu is another one that could have been a big star. I think a lot of the guys, I think, you know, I think there was obviously the talent was there for so many of the workers coming over from Japan. I think what was going to stunt them in the U.S. was going to be the booking. And, you know, this xenophobic booking that, would Choshu have been throwing salt in the eyes or something like that, something ridiculous. But certainly the talent was there. But again, getting back, and I'll say it a fifth time, if I had to pick one guy, it's Jumbo Sharuta.
Okay, Barry and I had not discussed this at all prior to the show. I'm going to read my notes verbatim. Don't want to sound xenophobic, comma, but language barrier an issue here. Promos matter. Jumbo Sharuta, comma, with manager. So we're on the same page. Barry, unfortunately, and this sucks, this was just pro wrestling life in the 70s and 80s. Yes, he would have been throwing salt. Yes, they would have dressed him up like Mr. Fuji or Mr. Saito. But as you stated, he was an elite in-ring performer, and he had the size, he had the look. I think once again, you would have had to have had a strong manager with him, but we're looking at a guy who could have main evented anywhere. Other candidates, obviously, when Sayama came over here in 82, 83, he was over like crazy because he was doing stuff on WWF TV that had never been imagined before, let alone seen before. I had people asking me, like literally 10 years later, I'd be introduced to someone, oh, he's the wrestling guy. Hey, I have a question for you. 10 years ago, there was this guy in a crazy mask who flew all over the place. That's how much of an impression Tiger Mask made. And Jushin Liger, same thing. If WCW, let's face it, WCW and Liger was there, was being booked by Bill Watts, and Watts just wasn't interested in that kind of thing, but Liger would have gotten over huge had they promoted him correctly.
The three guys I had were, I mean, it's where Siama, just because he's going to be great anywhere. And I also had Saruta and Riki Choshu. Those two, because they have very Western styles in my mind. I mean, I may be totally off, but when I see them, they it looks more a little different. It looks more Western. Jumbo reminds me a lot of just the way kind of his agility of a Terry Gordy.
Yeah,
almost that kind of just that quickness. And it just it seems a more of a Western style, especially Ricky with his presentation.
OK, I can see that.
So let me scooch down. I guess I wasn't gonna have a lot to say on that one. Let me scooch down a couple questions here. And Carl Wardlaw, what do you think makes a good referee, and who are the best referees and why?
So that's a good one too. And so what makes a good referee? So it's a, you know, I think there's a difference in territories, but I in my opinion, in any case, I think a good referee, and I am going to go back to the territory days versus anything that we're currently seeing, but I think a referee should obviously stay out of the way. But he shouldn't be the focal point of the match. And, you know, I think being in the right place, the right time, being able to work well, but you really want to be able to blend in to the match instead of, you know, trying to be the focal point in any way, shape or form. Again, growing up in Florida, and we had several referees that were down there, and I enjoyed them. And Sonny Myers, everything I just said, you can throw out the window, because Sonny Myers would come out and he would laugh during the matches, but he was so much fun to watch. Stu Schwartz was a great referee, though. And Stu Schwartz, to me, is one of these guys. You know, he was, I want to say 83, maybe 84, he was done. I know he was there, and he was still in Mid-Atlantic in 82 going into 83. But Stu Schwartz was kind of the prototype for a really, really good referee. He was a guy, first off, he looked fantastic. He was in as good a shape as anybody stepping into the ring. The guy worked out every day, looked like $1 million. But he had a certain authority about him. And, you know, sometimes when I see guys that are referees, maybe they're too small, or maybe they don't carry this kind of authority with them. And look, we know it's a work sport. We know in reality, this is just the third player to get the match over. But at the same time, if we're trying to sell the product, your referee should have some sort of authoritative look to him, or at least some sort of action. Tommy Young was good. My only issue with Tommy Young, and I think most people would say Tommy Young may be the greatest referee of all time, or maybe the most popular of all time, but Tommy Young sometimes did become the focal point of matches. And maybe that was demanded by the fans because he was getting over. But I don't know. Guys like Stu Schwartz were great. Here's the funny thing. You know, if you were to ask me, and I watch wrestling all the time, you know, I watch WWE probably every week. I, you know, occasionally take a week off, but if you asked me the name of one single referee right now, I don't think I'd be able to answer that question. Tiger Hattori was a great referee. Red Shoes, and Red Shoes, my only issue, Red Shoes sometimes does become the focal point of a match. Not, you know, not completely, but there are moments when he's involved with the match. I always thought Hattori was a fantastic referee. So, yeah, but it is funny. Like, I can't tell you the names of any of the referees that are in the WWE. Maybe it's a good thing that I can't do that. I don't know.
I think it is a good thing, and I agree with you with Johnny Red Shoes Dugan and Tommy Young. Sometimes they had far too large an input in the match. Like if I were the promoter, the first time I saw Tommy Young and Ric Flair doing that shoving thing, I would have fined both of them. I mean, it looked ridiculous. I don't care if it gets a pop. I don't like it. One thing that Barry and I disagree on, like, I think the referee should be an athlete and should be in shape, but I think he should be smaller than the wrestlers, if for no other reason than to emphasize how big the wrestlers are. If I ran a TV, I'd be all over that. I'd want everyone to be smaller than the wrestlers. So, I mean, the cliche in sports, actually, is the best umpires and referees are the ones you don't notice. But this is wrestling. I think the referees have to be credible. And Bill Watts did this perfectly with, like, Alfred Neely and Tommy Gilbert. They were credible. They didn't do anything goofy, but they made the storyline run more efficiently in the match. Another thing, they have to be at least decently athletic, and they need to be able to take a decent bump. As far as the best referees, I've already mentioned Alfred Neely, Tommy Gilbert was really good, Scrappy McGowan was really good, and his first name was Scrappy, so he gets extra points for that. Worst referee ever was David Manning. I mean, that guy just made himself way too big a part of the matches and the angles.
I completely agree with Tommy Young. I cannot. And here's another spot he did that drove me nuts. Because in every main event match that Tommy Young did, he got a spot. Mm-hmm. And there's no reason he should be getting a spot. But anyway, he'll do this thing where somebody's grabbing the ropes and he will kick the guy's hand. And then the announcers have to spend the next minute explaining why that's okay. It just stop it. It's not about Tommy. So I can't put him there. Here's one I was going to ask you about, Barry, who I always kind of liked, was Fonzie.
Yeah, Fonzie was good, too. And Fonzie was one of these guys. We saw him, I want to say it was 1981 was the first time that we ever saw Fonzie. And Fonzie was, as was just said, Fonzie was a smaller guy. So he wasn't a bigger guy who could be physically imposing when he came in. But Fonzie was always good. I forget who mentioned Tommy Gilbert. I always thought that he was a really, really great referee.
Yeah, I always liked Bill Alfonso as a referee as well. I liked his Florida work. He was one of those guys where you knew who he was and he had credibility, and he always seemed to be where he was supposed to be when he was supposed to be there. So I'm a fan of his.
And I'll mention one more, Paul Morton. In Memphis, yes. He's been there forever. Every once in a while, he'll get himself involved. But, I mean, less than Tommy Young. And he always really kind of had, just because of the million tattoos he had, he just kind of had that scary look anyway.
May I throw something in, too? I forgot to mention this. Brian Hildebrand might have been the best referee ever. How did I forget about him? He did everything he was supposed to do. He was the right size. And if the wrong guy got in the ring, Brian would turn him into a pretzel.
Yep. Outstanding point. How do we forget him? Okay, scoots down to 9, and we go to John English's question. Of all the guys who didn't go to the WWF during the 84 expansion, who's the one who should have and why?
Ooh, that is a good one right there. So for me, I think the first name that's going to come up is going to be Brody. And there'll always be, there's always the rumor that Brody was going to take this big payday and he was going to go to the WWF and face Hogan, be one of Hogan's challengers. But if Brody, and Brody was all about the money, I was a huge fan of Brody, and seeing him, to me, would have, in a sense, because I wasn't, I was so against the WWF when it expanded. I was strictly an NWA guy, and I just didn't like this. But in a sense, at least for me, which really doesn't mean anything, but for me, it would have legitimized what was taking place in the Northeast had you brought in Brody. And had you let Brody, think about when Buzz Sawyer came in, and how Buzz Sawyer, even in that very short time that he was there, just, you know, the craziness of him on television with the chains and doing the whole Buzz Sawyer deal. What if you had let Brody be himself, you know, certainly rein it in a little bit for safety reasons, but I think it would have been fantastic. You know, it maybe Stan Hansen. Stan Hansen's another one that never really got that great run against Hogan. I think those two, and I was such a fan of those two, I think that would have been great.
Well, I'll tell you what, one thing I want to throw in, Barry, I obviously, living here in New England during the WWF expansion, I didn't like it either. I did not like first of all, I got Florida Wrestling on TV for a while, and then as soon as that went off the air, I started getting Georgia, and I knew that both Georgia and Florida were way better than the WWF. I used to get Mid-South on cable, and that blew Florida and Georgia away, so I knew that WWF was not the best wrestling out there, like during the Backlund era, and it got even worse when it got silly in 84 and 85. So I'm basically on the same page you are. As far as guys, the way the question is, of all the guys who didn't go to the WWF during the 84 expansion, who's the one that should have and why? From a should have from the WWF standpoint, Ric Flair, for sure. They would have gotten the two biggest stars in the business, and I think that would have been a fatal blow to JCP. But I think Flair was happy going where he was. The guy that they really should have reeled in, I'm going to name two guys. I'm actually going to name three. Nikita would have been perfect, especially coming off Rocky IV being in the movie theaters, especially with the Cold War going on. If I'm Vince around Thanksgiving 1985 when Rocky IV came out, I do whatever I need to do to get Nikita Koloff into that company and in the main event for WrestleMania II. The third guy I'm going to mention is a very abstract guy. Lex Luger, too, even though he came in a little bit later. I think he would have been a perfect opponent for Hogan in like 86, 87. Supposedly, they talked to Luger, and we go back to what I said about Ricky Steamboat. You sign the contract, and they figure out what they're going to do with you whenever they figure it out. They gave Luger that same talk, you know, hey, just sign on, we'll figure it out later. And Crockett offered Luger a spot in the Horsemen and assured him that, hey, you're going to be our number one guy, and that made the difference. The last guy I think they should have brought in, and they could have gotten him, I'm sure. There was this dude up in Calgary around 86, 87. He went by the name of Steve Strong. I would have gone with his real name, Steve DeSalvo. He was the perfect WWF guy. He was huge. I mean, obviously, he had some chemical help going on. He could talk. He did a great interview, and he was a naturally arrogant heel. He wasn't much in the ring, but in the WWF, that didn't matter very much.
Thank you for giving me my big market tease. And Hanson's the guy for me. I want Hanson bringing that psycho routine he was doing in the AWA and scaring the hell out of everybody. I want him bringing that to New York and running him against Hogan. That you're going to be printing money. Hanson was scary at this point. Just sitting there like, you know, with the tobacco flying everywhere and the bell and, you know, you're sitting there like, how did he not kill five fans going to the ring alone? He was that kind of impactful at that point. And I think he would have made a great opponent for Hogan around that area, especially at the WrestleMania II. Aside of that, I'd also say, yeah, I agree with you guys. Basically, Nikita's obvious. And I don't love Brody, but Brody too. So,
hey, can I throw something in? I know you're sure. About to ask the next question.
Nope, go ahead.
I just wanted to interject this. I did not like the AWA version of Stan Hansen. As soon as I saw it, I'm like, what the hell is going on here? The 82, the like 81, 82 version of Stan Hansen as a heel in Georgia, I thought was way more intimidating and would have been a way better opponent for Hogan, even though Vince might have wanted the goofy stuff.
Exactly.
I think that would have been way better for the AWA and would have been way better for WCW when they brought him in 1990.
I don't know if you've noticed, but the AWA don't, the WWF doesn't do subtle. especially not in the mid 80s. So I agree with you. Of course, he's a better heel back then. But the guy that they're going to get one over on is the lunatic coming down, you know, swinging the cowbell all over the place. And I still think it'd be a great match for Hogan. So I'll take Stan however you want to give me Stan.
Yeah, did you guys, not to interrupt, did you guys ever see Stan Hansen when he was in Memphis? That's the Stan Hansen that should have gone to the WWF.
You got me on that one, Barry. Yeah, I saw him on TV, and I saw the clips of the match against Austin Idol. And you know what? Great point. I agree with you.
My answer to every one of these questions like this is always going to be Stan Hansen, by the way. As long as it's somewhere kind of where it's feasible. As long as Stan is somewhere between 14 and 59, I'm putting Stan in there because I love Stan. He's top five all time for me. Okay, so Randy Funk wants us to hop in the Wayback Machine and to take three guys from the 90s that we think could have been NWA world champion back in the day. So say like the 70s.
Three guys. So Kurt Angle, and that's probably the first name that comes to mind for me. Kurt Angle is the guy that, you know, we sit here and I'll have these conversations usually over alcohol. And it's like, so who could Jack Briscoe have had amazing matches with, a wrestler from the 90s? And to me, it's Kurt Angle. Like if you had put Kurt Angle and Jack Briscoe, and I'm talking about Jack in his prime as well, I just think Kurt Angle could have wrestled in any generation and the guy just would have been money without a doubt. Who else would have been really good in the 90s? But going back, I'm tempted to say Jumbo Sherrod again, because that's always my stock answer when I look for something like this. So I would say Jumbo Sherrod. That's the two. I'm going to have to think on a third. But Kurt Angle to me is the obvious. I mean, Kurt Angle, my God, could you imagine Kurt Angle as your NWA World's Heavyweight Champion, wrestling 7-8 times a week, having hour-long matches with the top guys in every single territory? It would have been a dream.
You know, I agree with you. And Sean had actually mentioned Kurt Angle in his notes. And this is me just being a pedantic pain in the ass. If I recall correctly, did Kurt debut on the 99 Survivor Series? If he did, I mean, I think that kind of puts him out of the 90s. But I agree with you. Like, he's more of a 2000s guy. But I agree totally that, hey, this guy would have been the perfect 1970s NWA champion. The only other guys that I could really think of that fit the mold would be either version of Stone Cold, either Stone Cold Steve Austin or Stunning Steve Austin. The other one I came up with was Bret Hart. And I think some of you are probably saying, you know, okay, you know, Bret, you're picturing 1995 Bret. It wouldn't be that. It would be Bret, you know, out of that costume in the black tights and black boots, and he would have been fine.
So I agree. Like I said, my first thought was Stunning Steve from the 90s when he had his knees and his neck and he was completely healthy. The guy was a machine. I jokingly said Terry Funk. And Kurt Angle to me is the obvious one. He has the size. You could say Brock Lesnar, but the problem with Brock Lesnar at this point, he looks too unbeatable. It would be like a big Bill Miller thing, or a Bill Watts thing, where you just didn't want to have the NWA champ look like he couldn't possibly be beaten. So he would be out. Like I said, Bret was too small. Here's one, though, that's kind of out there, but stylistically it might fit. Steve Regal.
That's an interesting pick.
What do you think, Barry? Mr. Excitement.
Yeah, and I think that's it, too. I think with Steve Regal, I think he was – I mean, a fantastic wrestler. We featured a Steve Regal versus Fit Finlay match this past week on our podcast, Breaking Kayfabe with Baldrin and Barry. I just don't know if Regal as a world champion for whatever reason. I do – Stunning Steve Austin, I can see. I don't see Stone Cold. That's a totally different thing. Bret Hart, though, Bret Hart falls into that mold – when you look at him, at least from a physical standpoint, of an AWA or NWA World's Heavyweight Champion in the 70s. Same build as, say, a Jack Briscoe, you know, a Terry Funk, similar build, a Nick Bockwinkel. So that actually makes a lot of sense to me.
And when you look, when you listen to Bret Hart do an interview, especially when he first became WWF champion, his interviews felt like that classic NWA style. Like, you know, hey, I am a serious athlete. This is a serious sport. And I'm doing a serious interview. So I like Bret. I mean, Bret's my number one on this. Steve Regal, I just don't see it. Even though I was a huge Steve Regal fan, one of the best matches I've ever seen live was at the Brian Pillman Memorial Show in 2001. They had Chris Benoit and Steve Regal go out there for like 17, 18 minutes, and they just destroyed each other. They didn't bounce off the ropes or anything. They just like went with this complete legit looking offense. And it the match is out there on tape somewhere, or tape. It's out there available on video. Seek it out. It is a 5-star match.
My thing with Regal is I think him stylistically works better in the 70s. Just first of all, that physical style, that kind of in your, you know, down south, it's all over that. You know, the physical contact and that, you know, how tight he works. And I mean, the kind of snarky promos as a heel. I don't know. I just think he would be better. He would be a better fit at that time. How big was Bret, John?
Bret was a big guy. He really was. I mean, he was thick. He wasn't, you know, a caricature, like, you know, Vince liked his monster heels, but he was a big guy. I don't think that would be an issue at all.
What was his weight?
Legit, I would say somewhere around, I would say somewhere around 240, 245. If you look at that,
really?
If you look at that documentary, what was it? Help me out here, someone. The one where they did the Montreal screw job. I mean, you see Bret walking around in civilian clothing. Okay, thank you. See him walking around with civilian clothing. You're like, holy crap, this is a huge dude.
Well, I mean, they're all big, but the thing I'm thinking of is the fact that this was the crack on Jerry Briscoe for years, and Bobby Shane for that matter, too, was that neither one could be considered world championship material because they were too small. And I kind of, if you look at Bret, especially that era, you know, he doesn't look much bigger than those guys are. So
Bobby Shane was 5'8". Bobby Shane was a guy that I saw, and I don't see Bobby Shane as an NWA World's Heavyweight Champion. I don't think that would ever be in any sort of consideration. And when Bobby passed away, he had just been brought in to book Florida, so he was actually transitioning. Still going to be talent, obviously, but he was learning the booking, and he was only, you know, it was his late 20s when he passed away. I don't see him as a World's Heavyweight Champion. But he's a guy, you know, Buddy Colt's one of those guys. Buddy Colt is somebody that, you know, a lot of people have talked about, and Buddy Colt has said it, that he was being considered for the NWA World's Heavyweight title. I'm not sure I see that either, to be honest with you.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, John.
No, I was going to say, I agree with, I agree that, you know, Bobby Shane was a little too small. I think Bret Hart was bigger than Jerry Briscoe, bigger, thicker, and more muscular.
Yeah.
Okay. Shane is an extreme example. My point was the fact that they will eliminate outstanding wrestlers on both sides of the spectrum on size issues.
Sure.
For back in the day. So, okay. Do you think there was anyone else, Flair and the Von Erichs excluded, who would have been a viable choice as the touring NWA champion during the 80s? I'm guessing this means the early 80s.
Oh, so you're looking for somebody who would have been successful in the earlier mid 80s as a touring world champion?
Yes, I'm guessing the point here is not just one of those, and they put Von Erich here, so I mean, he would be out, but I mean that quick, dusty kind of Tommy Rich kind of thing, like a guy who could carry the belt.
Right, but a very, very short run, maybe a week, a month, 3 months, something like that.
No, I was thinking more along the lines of a guy who could do the Ric Flair thing. Guy who could carry the belt full time.
Like let's say Ric Flair didn't exist. Who could it have been?
So this was something I always thought. I always thought Paul Orndorff had it. And when I talk about Orndorff, I'm going back to his days on TBS. He looked like $1 million. He was solid in the ring. I think the flaw in Orndorff's game, at least at that stage, was really anytime he got near a microphone. He just didn't always make a ton of sense and just didn't work. But I think had he maybe had somebody spent more time with him, I don't know if I really have the answer as to what would have made it more successful. I think Orndorff is the kind of guy, based off of his ring work at that stage and certainly his look, that would have been a very viable world's heavyweight champion.
I agree with you. I have three names written, and the first one is Paul Orndorff. I agree with you 100%. When he first came on TBS after his run in Mid-South Wrestling, and by this point now, WTBS is growing. It's, you know, more and more eyeballs are seeing this show, and he looked dynamite. His interviews, I thought his interviews were fine as far as, once again, I'm going back to this, you know, hey, I'm an athlete. This is how we athletes talk. I am doing a serious interview because this is a serious sport. Next up, Ted DiBiase, I think is obvious. DiBiase's only negative is back in 1979, despite being the North American champion, he was kind of a middle of the card guy. I mean, once you got past him having a belt, which, you know, really didn't mean a lot at the time, he was kind of just another Tito Santana, Steve Travis type. I think he needed to go out and have a really good run with Crockett first, you know, winning the United States title. He needed a successful run in Florida, a better run in Georgia than he had in 1981, where they've got him teaming with JYD and Frazier against the Freebirds. My third pick, before I go off on a tiny little rant, is Stan Hansen. I know Stan was very happy, you know, doing his Japan thing, doing Georgia in between. But, you know, the NWA title, it meant a lot of money. And I think Hansen would have done well in that role. Here's something I want to talk about really quickly. For the most part, when the promotions showed you, okay, this is the NWA champion, for the most part, fans accepted it. Yes, I know some guys drew better than others, but I really think there is an alternate universe where Terry Funk never asked for the NWA championship to be taken off of him, where he held the title until 1981, and people think it's preposterous that Harley Race could have done what he did. Because Harley, he was a little bit overweight, you know, he didn't have the best wrestling body, and he didn't have the kind of color that we were starting to get used to seeing in wrestling by the late 70s.
I guess, but with Harley, there was a certain, well, first of all, you know why they used him, because they don't want to use a superstar as the NWA champion. There is a morbid fear about having like some guy like Luthez who ends up being bigger than the belt, and then you have all kinds of problems. That's why Dusty's never getting a long ring. You wanted a guy who was kind of, you know, look what happened with Ric Flair. You wanted some guy like a Jack Briscoe who was a star, but he wasn't gonna, you know, he wasn't gonna fill up a room, you know, like a Dusty Rhodes would, you know, be the larger than life kind of guy. So they always seem to stay away from that. The guy I would use, and to me, I have one word answer on my notes here, Ted DiBiase. He's a five-tool guy. He can play big. He can play small. He's a great babyface. He's a great heel. And when he does it, he's a completely different guy, which is a rarity. Usually, there'll be like Flair or Lawler. They'll just do a little tweak to it where all of a sudden they'll emphasize certain things and they become a heel or a face. No, Ted's an entirely different human being when he comes out as a face or he comes out as a heel. And he'll do it on the same show, which is just amazing. So for me, I don't know. I think it's Ted. I'm doing them out of order. I apologize in advance. I just want to try to get as many people involved as possible. Stan Guzik, if you could have one booker to turn around Georgia in 82 and 83 to replace Ole, who would it be and what direction would you go?
Oh, that is interesting. So I would actually, and I did read the notes on this one too, but I'm going to go different. I'm going to say Louis Tillette. And I'm going to tell you, Louis Tillette, is, for some people, was a polarizing booker. He had an amazing run in the early 1970s in Florida. He was the booker for two and a half years, which, you know, that to be a booker in a viable, exciting territory, and to keep that territory exciting for 2.5 years, that's almost unheard of. He came back and he worked in Florida as a booker in 79, which was a very exciting time, took over for Buddy Rogers after Eddie Graham fired Buddy Rogers and Louis took over. He did make the cardinal mistake of putting himself in the ring and working programs. And he was close to 50 years old, grossly overweight, looked like he was having a heart attack, but he had a mind for booking. He also booked for Fuller. He booked down in Continental and actually booked in Los Angeles and made Los Angeles kind of exciting in a time when it was a transition time. He, you know, brought in the Hollywood Blondes, brought in Greg Valentine, did some really interesting things right there. In the early 80s, Louis had a falling out with Eddie Graham, and he wound up being the booker for the great Malenko Don Curtis promotion, Sunbelt. And I don't think he really booked major territories again. So I think that's a guy right there that I would have looked at. Another guy that I would have looked at, the great Mephisto. And the great Mephisto had really, you know, you look at what he did when he ran opposition to Cowboy Bill Watts in the late 70s when he was working for the Culkins. And he had a very small crew right there. That's where the Freebirds got their start. He had a very small crew, but he was so inventive. You know, and I've always felt that was the strong point of Bill Watts, that Bill Watts could take guys that normally maybe you didn't really care a lot about, and he could make them interesting. And certainly if you did care about them, he made them really interesting. But that's two guys I would have looked at. I would have looked at Great Mephisto and Louis Tillette.
All right. Here are the guys that I would have looked at. Now, one issue with Pat Patterson, can you get him? I mean, he is with the WWF. He has an office position. You know, it looks like he has a long future promised to him, but he would have been first on my list. Second guy, and especially given the timeline, 82-83. And Barry, you would know more about this than I would, but it looked like the sun was kind of going down on the Dusty Rhodes era in Florida right around this time. The promotion was starting to run out of gas. I would have, you know, obviously Dusty got the position in Mid-Atlantic in 84 and then on TBS in 85. I might have been a couple of years early to the party and said, Dusty, you know, would you like to leave Florida and come book here? My third pick, and it would have been based on his work with Bill Watts, would have been Ernie Ladd. Ernie had a lot of really good ideas, and, you know, obviously if Watts trusted him, they had good television when Ernie Ladd was there. So, you know, if I can't get Patterson, if I can't get Rhodes, I think I can definitely get Ernie Ladd. Now, they asked, what direction would you go? Now, 1983, Georgia was a mess. There's no disguising it. They got rid of all of their who I consider their top performers. Paul Orndorff, Ivan Koloff, Stan Hansen, the Freebirds. I can go on and on, but the good guys from 82 were gone because Ole wanted to cut the amount of money he was spending on wrestlers. Okay, understandable. But I thought he brought in the wrong guys: Larry Zbysko, Killer Brooks, Pez Whatley. No, I'm not saying anything bad about those guys, but we all know they're not main eventers. What they should have done is, I mean, really scour the talent base from across everything that's going on in the United States. I mean, Dr. D. David Schultz was still in Portland in 1982. Billy Jack Haynes was in Portland. Dynamite Kid was in Portland. You had wrestlers in Southwest who probably might have wanted to get out of there, like Tully Blanchard. You had younger guys who had futures, like Tom Pritchard, Terry Allen. That's more the direction I would have gone in than the guys Ole had brought in.
I'm feeling more confident about my answer now because I'm thinking of what's being left in Georgia. So you basically have to have a guy to rebuild the entire thing. And my problem is I'm not sure they still get along, but the guy for this, and he's about to, if not leaving Dallas, is Gary Hart. I mean, it's not going to be like a long term. It's going to make it great. But if you need, he's like your Marty Schottenheimer. You know, he's the guy who could come in and take something that's a disaster and get you to a certain level again. And then you can bring somebody in to bring the rest of the way. But if you're going to need to do a complete rebuild, I would say I would go with Gary Hart.
You know, one thing I'd like to interject here. We talk about Ole Anderson. He felt like he needed to use less expensive talent because Georgia was no longer drawing. You know, and that kind of bothers me because it's not like your houses are fixed. Like you're only drawing 2,000 or 3,000 people at the Omni. If you bring in talent, your gates will rise. And you can't just say, okay, I'm not going to spend money on talent. If Ole feels like, okay, you know, the Freebirds or whoever aren't drawing, the Orndorff-Koloff feud apparently didn't draw particularly well, go with other guys. But don't just throw guys like Larry Zbysko and Killer Brooks out there. I'm sorry.
And the other thing I would do is, as far as the plan goes, is keep a couple top level guys, but go young. Go sit there and look for Tom Pritchard and all these guys who are, you know, in their 20s somewhere, and get as many young guys who, you know, you can develop into your system as you can. But yeah, I when I wrote down Gary Hart, I'm like, now as you guys talked about what a mess Georgia was, I'm like, yeah, actually this is a good idea for him. Ron Gamble. What happens if Crockett wins the war between Vince and the WWF and JCP?
What happens if I don't know. That's an interesting one there that I would have to give some thought. You know, if he was to win, how would it have changed things? You know, there's a lot. So what if Vince, you know, maybe even more so, what if Vince had failed? And what would have happened with the landscape of professional wrestling? I think, would we have seen another promotion? You know, so if he wins and Vince fails, I think Vince goes under. I think something happens to the territory and he goes under. Would we have seen an emergence of a third national promotion? Gents, what do you think?
Well, it's a tough question. It's almost like, you know, what would the earth be like if there were no oceans? Okay. I mean, it's a tough one.
Great analogy.
I think what would have happened if Crockett had won, I can't help but think that pro wrestling eventually would have gone the way of roller derby. I think that it was just too promoting like that on a national and international scale was just too much for Jim Crockett. I think if Vince had failed early enough, which he could have in 85, I mean, WrestleMania was a far bigger success than I think even Vince thought it would be, and that bailed him out. Let's say if WrestleMania had failed, I think Bill Watts would have seen this opportunity, and I think Bill Watts would still be the number one promoter in the world. I think Bill had a greater vision and just a better overall product. And let's be honest, you know, Jim Crockett, he seemed like a nice guy and not a cutthroat kind of guy like Vince McMahon was, like Bill Watts was. I think Bill Watts, he would have been the guy who would have then taken out Crockett.
Yeah, John, you were right when you said roller derby. He created too big of a vacuum at this point that if he went under, it wasn't like if Vince tried this 10 years earlier, it never happens. The reason Vince was able to do this is because you had a bunch of territories that were falling apart anyway. It wasn't Vince's fault that Georgia was falling apart. It wasn't Vince's fault that Florida was falling apart. That was happening anyway, or Los Angeles or San Francisco or all these other places that were strongholds at one point. That was happening either way, and you know, Vince just happened to take advantage of an opportunity. So that's why I'm thinking that it goes down to nothing again, and you're starting from scratch.
One thing, though, and I want to say this, like, yeah, Georgia was going through a rough time. Florida was going through a rough time. I agree with that. But territories have gone through rough times and have bounced back. Like
Detroit.
Every promotion has. The reason the WWF became successful really had nothing to do with, you know, Georgia, Florida not being – not doing well. The WWF was doing so well in 1983, they were on fire. And it was just a matter of, okay, the technology is now here for a promotion to go national. Vince saw that and he went for it. Terry Funk once told me when – he told me that when in 1979 Georgia Wrestling came on cable TV at his house in Amarillo, Texas, and Terry said, that's it. The territories are dead. I think Vince probably saw it maybe a couple of years after, but he saw it.
Southwest and Amarillo. In Indianapolis, if he tries this in 1981, it doesn't work. Even if he had the technology, it doesn't work because everything was too strong at that point. He had the technology. Something would have happened eventually, but at this point, it wasn't just Vince. It was because a lot of these territories were falling apart anyways. I mean, the only ones that were still viable were Memphis, JCP, and Portland, you know, and maybe, you know, one or two smaller others. But, I mean, that was – yeah, world class. But I mean, that was pretty much it. So I mean, you were gonna have a, and if Vince collapsed, I don't see anything unless JCP can hustle and kind of fill that void fast. Because you're right, it's only gonna be Vince collapsing. So okay, let us go back to Jesus, and I'm not even sure how to. So I'll let you guys take this as you will. But you find a genie that you can wrestling genie. Okay. You found a wrestling genie that asked you three pro wrestling wishes. What are your choices?
Wow. Okay. Jesus coming up with the questions.
I know.
Yeah, as he always does, too. That's actually a good one right there. So I'm definitely inclined to make this about attractive females coming on to me, which seems like the easy route to go. But, you know, and I mean like attractive, like valets, like Missy Hyatt in 1987 when I was madly in love with her. But looking at professional wrestling, what would I – so this is like the holy grail. And I've actually posed this question in our Facebook group before. So I would want a compilation DVD set as much as I could possibly get between the feud of Eddie Graham and the Great Malenko. It essentially created CWF and – nothing exists, at least that I'm aware of. There is a 25-second clip of one of their matches from the 1960s that I own, and that's it. And there's nothing else. The greatest heel turn that I ever saw was the Joe LeDuc heel turn in Florida. And this is the one where it dragged on for weeks. And he basically Jimmy Garvin said that Sonny King owns Joe LeDuc and he's waiting on the footage. And this was like 3 weeks. So I don't know. This is like coming by fucking like a horse, right? Like, you know, 3 weeks later, we still don't have the footage. Right. So they finally get the footage. They air it. Joe LeDuc attacks Jimmy Garvin, puts him in the bear hug, and Jimmy Garvin starts to bleed from the mouth. And Gordon Solie is selling this like it's the greatest thing that's ever happened. I mean, Gordon Solie was just such a master at that stage. And with all of the footage that's out there, and there's a lot of 1970s Florida footage, we can't find this anywhere. So those are the two things that I would look for. If there was a third thing, what would the third thing be? I guess more Billy Robinson. Billy Robinson is my favorite wrestler of all time. And if I could get more Billy Robinson from the early 1970s, maybe the early to mid 1970s, that would be great. I could just watch his matches all day long.
I'll tell you what, this was a really good question to have as the last question on the show. But Barry, I've got to ask you one more question.
Yeah, please.
Because I have no idea about this Garvin LeDuc angle. You said it took about 3 weeks. Did it kind of look like Jimmy Garvin was the one who was going to come out the bad guy making up this stuff about Joe LeDuc?
So, you know what? It's slightly ambiguous. And what I will do is I've got – so we did – well, you guys went over that. We did the top 25 angles, and we talked about the Joe LeDuc heel turn. And you guys referenced it, I think, when you were talking about the top 25 angles in CWF history. But I do have a lot of promo material, like the stuff that came out of the programs, which I'll post in your group. So slightly – Yeah, absolutely. Maybe to some degree. The thing was, Joe LeDuc had always been a baby face in the state of Florida, and he was a loved baby face. You know, initially came in 1973 with his worked brother, Paul LeDuc, Florida tag team champions. And Joe was a guy that was that number two or number three baby face in the promotion. Dusty up top, you know, maybe Jack Briscoe, number two, whoever, and then maybe Joe LeDuc. You know, he was never the top guy, though he was in plenty of main events and had a ton of feuds. So he was loved. Garvin was a guy that had come in maybe a year earlier before this angle, maybe even a little bit less. And, you know, I don't think that people were I don't want to say that it was that he was turning heel or people were going to perceive him as a heel, but I don't think he had the credibility in the fans' eyes that Joe LeDuc had. So
I like it.
Yeah. So there was something to it. Of course, you know, us being hardcore fans, that small group that I was in, we knew that he had already been a heel in Memphis and what a great heel he was, you know, in throwing Jerry Lawler over the top rope onto the timekeeper's table. So they really stretched it out week after week. And it was, you know, that was the beauty of Florida, was a lot of things, the trigger wasn't pulled immediately. So, you know, even like the Ernie Ladd heel turn, which had taken place a year and a half to 2 years earlier, that was done over 3 or 4 weeks. And the question of, it wasn't a question of, you know, is he going to turn heel? It's a question of when is he going to turn heel and where is he going to turn heel? So when the Garvin thing and the LeDuc heel turn took place, we knew it was going to come at some point, but I don't think anybody watching that day expected that this lovable giant babyface Joe LeDuc was going to turn into this crazed maniac and in, you know, Garvin bleeding from the mouth. And I go back and I'm like, okay, so how many times in the 70s was there an angle in Florida where a guy bled from the mouth? And I could think of one other that ever took place. So it wasn't an overused angle. It was very impactful at the time. And that's what you're looking for.
All right. I'll tell you what, we're running a little bit over and we'll live with that because I want Sean to be able to answer this question as well. I will answer it. Barry, the only negative thing about you being on this show is you and I are so alike. It's almost redundant because I'm reading right from my notes. Okay. You found a genie that asked you for 3 pro wrestling wishes. What are your choices? Quote, my first one involves the 1988 versions of Missy Hyatt and Elizabeth. Notice I said and.
Yeah. So if I can interject for 1 second, so I'll go to my grave, which hopefully is in many years, but I'll go to my grave that Missy Hyatt in 1987, John Tatum and then Eddie Gilbert wearing that blue leather dress that she used to wear was my absolute favorite wrestling manager, valet, any female involved with wrestling. She was my absolute favorite. There will only be one. Miss Elizabeth never did anything for me, strangely enough, but Missy Hyatt absolutely did at that stage.
Missy, I hope you're listening. I agree with him. You are a smoke show. Anyway, my number one, actually that would be my number one serious one, but number one, all recorded television has now becomes available. Anything that was televised, a genie pops up and we have access to it. Number two, we rewrite history. The 1970s and early 1980s Boston Garden shows that become broadcast on cable like the Madison Square Garden shows. This way I get to go back and see whether or not that 1982 Bob Backlund versus Bob Orton Jr. match or that 1983 Bob Backlund versus Ivan Koloff match, if those matches were as good as I remember them being right around 4.5, 4.75 stars. Number three, I wish I had been born like 10, 15 years earlier. I got really lucky in 88. I got to travel to Memphis. I got to see the Saturday morning TV taping and then the Monday night television show. I would have liked to have done that everywhere in Los Angeles, in World Class, in Florida, Georgia, the Carolinas, you know, go to a TV taping and then go see a couple of house shows. Sean, it comes to you. 3 wishes.
One that just came up to the top of my head is tickets to go see anything, pro wrestling, sure, why not, at the old, I think it's MSG 2, no, 3, back in the late 50s with that great awning, and you had all the gamblers outside. Oh, that place was great. So I would say that's up there. I would say I'd like to see Ray Stevens in the Cow Palace before his injuries back in the early 60s. And I actually posted the match a few weeks ago on the Facebook page. It was Ray Stevens, who may have been 15 at the time, against Buddy Rogers in Ohio back in the mid 50s. It just that to see that would be fantastic. I would like to see some of the early 70s Memphis, particularly 74 Memphis stuff, the TV. I'd like to be able to meet Lance Russell.
As I think both Barry and I were lucky enough to have done. I got to meet him twice, three times. I'm a lucky dude. Barry, have you ever met Lance?
I have. So I was at the WFIA convention in 1979. That was where the Freebirds debuted in Memphis. Hulk Hogan was there with his brother, Dizzy Hogan. And we got to meet Lance. And everything that anybody will ever tell you about Lance was 100% true. He was the nicest guy ever. Just a sweetheart of a guy. And that was a good time. And you were you there in the 80s, John?
Yeah, I was there in 1988, and I was also there in 1995. I didn't get to go to the tapings, but I got to go to the Mid-South Coliseum, and I met Lance when he was in Boston in 1989. Barry, I thank you so much for taking the time to be on the show. You were an outstanding guest, and you also have a show on the Arcadian Vanguard Network, a podcast network. Am I right?
Absolutely. Yes, you were. John, you are 100% correct, as I like to say to Jeff every week. But yes, you are correct, too. It is Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry. I am obviously the Barry part of that. We just celebrated our second anniversary. It was show 104, which is astounding to me. We have never missed a week through illnesses, marriages, weddings, moves, everything. My kid went off to college. Like, you know, just so much has taken place. But yet somehow every week we have shown up and we talk about a lot of stuff. We don't. You guys stick to wrestling. We talk about food. We talk about movies. As Jeff likes to say, we even break kayfabe on life. And if I can get one more quick plug in, yeah, absolutely. So I have been a partner in running FanFest for professional wrestling in the state of Florida for the last couple of years. And we have our sixth event coming up on November the 9th in the beautiful suburb of Tampa, Lutz, Florida. Have you guys ever heard of Lutz?
I have not.
Gotcha. So Lutz is actually where Dusty Rhodes had a ranch, and it was in Lutz. It was an old kind of farm town, pastures, and in the last 10 years, it's become kind of this really beautiful area. So we're in a hotel in Lutz, and we've got seven names. And our fan fests are a little bit different. It's not your traditional stand in line for a 30-second meet and greet. It's very interactive, and we limit our tickets to 200, and then we do special events throughout the day. So we're starting off in the morning. We're doing Cup of Coffee with Rocky Johnson. Rocky's going to sit with 30 fans, discuss his new autobiography that's coming out that he worked on with Scott Teal. We go into our fan fest, and then it is 2-hour Q&A with Barry Windham and J.J. Dillon. Real excited. Barry has been our number one most requested guest, and we're very happy that we can deliver. And then afterwards, Dutch Mantel is going to be performing his one-man show, which has been getting rave reviews. So we've got these little private events that we limit to only 30 fans, but the fan fest itself will see all that talent, which is Barry Windham, J.J. Dillon, Rocky Johnson, Dutch Mantel, but also joining them, Tony Gurria, a guy that both of you gentlemen would be extremely familiar with. Tony Gurria will be there. Larry Hamilton will also be there. Larry Hamilton, if you remember, was known as Thunderbolt Hamilton, never done a fan fest before. This is going to be his first one, so we're really excited to have him. And Kendall Windham, another guy that has never done a fan fest before, the Windham brothers will be riding into Lutz on November the 9th. You can get tickets at eventbrite.com. You can also find us on Facebook. It is CWF Legends Fan Fest. As Freddie Miller used to say, be there.
Sounds really good. You know, and really quickly, I went to your page and I see this, Florida Championship Wrestling Florida Archives. And I see this. I'm like, is that Tony Garea? Is someone trying to draw Morocco and it looks like Tony Garea? And then I saw what it was. But anyway, thank you again, Barry, for being on. It was a great show. Sean, thank you for all you do for the show. And we also want to thank our producer, Lou Kippelman, who does a lot behind the scenes. I want to thank Brian Lass for giving us this forum. And this has been a broadcast of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. We'll see you next week. Go Vols!